Hi, you're listening to the weekly podcast of Life Ministry Church. For more information, head to our website, www.lmc.org.au.
It is our absolute privilege and pleasure to have Mark Harwood with us, and he's got an amazing message for us tonight. Can we welcome him to the stage as he shares this night?
Well, good evening, everyone. Good evening, everyone. You there? You're there. Wonderful. It is a great privilege to be here. I always say that because it's always true. I just love the opportunities to share with people about the authority, the truth, the reliability of the Word of God. Because without it, we would have no idea, would we, what is going on in this world of ours. You know, I am also a father, and I guess I've probably been guilty of the odd dad joke. For instance, you heard about the snail that wanted to go faster, so he got rid of his shell, but it just made him sluggish. Oh, that was terrible. You know, critics of the Christian faith often say to us that you guys believe things without any evidence. And often people will say to me, look, I understand you've got your religious beliefs, but I go where the evidence leads. I go where science points. So often people have signed up to science as the authority in their lives. But it seems to me that, in fact, that's not really true at all. As a matter of fact, I think that it's more the case that those who reject the Christian message are going opposite or against what the evidence says. And that's what I want to share with you tonight. So the title of my talk tonight is Going Where the Evidence Leads. Now, I use this title somewhat cautiously because I don't want to give you the impression that our faith is based on our ability to understand God and to read the evidence correctly and end up with the conclusion that there is a God. Now, there is a component of that, of course, but faith is always involved. And that's what I want to elaborate a little on tonight. Now, the most common area, of course, of challenge that the secular culture brings against Christianity is in the area of origins. The opening chapters of the Bible are quite unequivocal that God created. In fact, they tell us that God created everything in six normal length days, just like the days we experience now. And importantly, though, the very first words in the scripture are these: in the beginning, God. So there's, if you like, a causal agent behind this universe. The universe was created. It didn't simply make itself, which is, of course, the secular alternative. So the story that we're told in our culture is very different, isn't it? It says that over vast, unimaginable periods of time, random, unguided processes started with this massive explosion 3.8 billion years ago, and through all these untold accidents, we finally end up with this planet and you and me gathered here together this evening. Now, I'm sure you'll understand and appreciate that there's an enormous difference between those two versions of our origins. Sometimes people wonder, why do the secularists need so many billions and billions of years? Well, what this evolution story is really about is an attempt to explain the existence of the entire universe without God. You see, the evolutionary story limits itself to naturalistic explanations. Now, if you're working in the sciences, that sounds pretty reasonable, right? You want to understand how did it work, what happened. So you seek natural explanations. But when we're talking about origins, we're not talking about how the universe works, but how it came to be. And that's a whole different philosophical argument or area of debate. So if we limit ourselves to naturalistic explanations, what we're doing right at the outset and arbitrarily is exclude any possibility of a supernatural origin for the universe. Now, if you ignore the supernatural or if you refuse to acknowledge it, you are essentially saying there is no God. So the fundamental assumption behind the evolutionary story, not likely to be written down or even spoken out, but it is nonetheless, there is no God. Now that means it's atheistic. So the culture we live in has adopted an atheistic worldview in an attempt to get rid of God in this whole question of origins. So I like to say that evolution is, if you like, atheism dressed up in a lab coat. So it comes with all the authority of the scientific establishment, but it is really just a belief system. Some people say to us, you know, this isn't really a very important issue for Christians. What Christians need to be doing is sharing the gospel with others. You know, this whole topic of origins is complicated. It's shrouded in complexity and science and so on. But I want to share with you a rather interesting quotation. This guy, Dan Brown, is the author of The Da Vinci Code. Who's heard of The Da Vinci Code? You might have read the book or seen the movie or something. Now, he was interviewed and talking about his upbringing, and he said this: I was raised Episcopalian and I was very religious as a kid. Then in eighth or ninth grade, I studied astronomy, cosmology, and the origins of the universe. I remember saying to a minister, I don't get it. I read a book that said there was an explosion known as the Big Bang, but here it says God created heaven and earth in 7 days, which is right. Unfortunately, the response I got was, nice boys don't ask that question. A light went off and I said, the Bible doesn't make sense. Science makes much more sense to me. And I just gravitated away from religion. What a tragedy. That minister could not answer Dan Brown's very good question. What a difference it might have made if he'd been able to answer the question with a good, solid, credible response. A survey was done by the Barnard Group. Some of you may have heard of them. They do the Pew Research things. And it was a global survey of the millennials. That's the 18 to 35-year-old age group, young people. And one of the questions was this one: what makes you doubt things of a spiritual dimension? And there's a whole bunch of suggested topics along here, and they were to choose which one. And you know, it's interesting, in Australia and New Zealand, the number one barrier or obstacle to faith was science. Now, that's not the science of the laboratory where you measure things like the temperature at which water boils and so on. It's the science that says the universe came about by accident. In other words, there is no God. So if there's no God, why would you have an interest in spiritual things? And so they don't. Now, as I travel around to churches in this country and others, I find often a very significant lack of young people. Where have they gone? That's where they've gone. Science has told them that there is no God. You all got here by accident, not by purposeful design. But friends, the Bible says very plainly that we are always to be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have, but to do this with gentleness and respect. Now, as I shared this morning, when I was a young man, I grew up believing that God must have used evolution to create. So I could not do this. I don't mean the gentleness and respect bit. I mean, I didn't have answers to my own questions. Therefore, I wasn't confident in trying to share my faith with others because they might ask me something that I could not answer. And then I'd look a fool. So I kept my head down under the parapet, as it were. If you'd known me in my high school and university days, you probably wouldn't have known I was a Christian. I didn't do all the things that my engineering colleagues did, but nonetheless, I did not declare my faith because I could not defend it. So this, by the way, is not a suggestion. This is an instruction, isn't it? Always be prepared to give an answer. How do you get prepared to address a complex issue like origins? Well, you don't have to know all the answers. Nobody does. But there are a number of vital resources that I want to tell you about. And we've got a whole stack of things over there on the tables at the side. Perhaps our flagship publication as a ministry is the Creation Magazine. I'll tell you more about it later, but a lot of the illustrations I'm going to use today come from past issues of Creation Magazine. We have a website. This is what the front page looks like. Up in the top right-hand corner, there's a search window. It gives you access to over 13,000 different articles and items of interest that are all aimed at encouraging you in your faith. There's a new feature article there every day of the week, and we encourage people to log on and read it and be uplifted in your confidence in your faith. Now, one of the really good things about our website is it has a very easy web address to remember. Now, it turns out that if you say something at the same time as seeing it, it helps to imprint it into your memory. So I want you to say the web address with me when it comes up onto the screen. All right, is everyone ready for that? Okay, so if you want to know anything about creation, you just go to
creation.com.
Couldn't be any easier, could it? I had the great privilege of working in the aerospace industry for some 30 or so years. I was involved in the design of all of Australia's national satellites. Now, I'm sure you've seen those little dishes on rooftops pointing up at the sky. They get things like Foxtel, Austar, ABC, SBS, the TV networks, and all the pay television stuff. Now, I need to make sure you're very clear here. I have no accountability whatsoever for what comes over the satellites, all right? You do understand that. But I did have a lot to do with the design of the spacecraft themselves. Now, Australia's national satellite system is operated by Optus. And I know that a lot of you here tonight will have Telstra phones, and I'm happy to pray with you after the meeting. But anyway, no, just kidding. The kind of science that I was involved in is what you could call experimental science. That's the kind of science that depends upon observable, repeatable experiments. So a scientist can conduct an experiment, discover something, report it, another scientist in another country can repeat the experiment to confirm the results. And that's how our understanding of how this universe works progresses. And we learn more and more and are able to harness that knowledge in the invention of amazing things. But the important thing is it depends upon observable, repeatable experiments. But there's another kind of science, and we could call it historical science. Now, this is still science, but it has a difference. And the difference is this. This guy is looking at this rock, and in it he sees a fossil, and he then tries to explain how this fossil came to be. So he makes up a story about the past to explain what he's observing. Now, if he believes the evolutionary story with its millions and millions of years of unguided random processes, then when he looks at that fossil, he might well think, I wonder where this little fossil fits in that long, slow progression from the first primordial cell all the way up to complex organisms like you and me. I can imagine him asking, I wonder how many millions of years ago it lived. So can you see that what he already believes about its origins influences how he interprets the evidence? Does that make sense? But let's imagine that this guy was a Bible-believing Christian. When he looks at that little fossil in the rock, he may well think, you know, this fossil was likely laid down as a result of Noah's flood, which would have deposited pretty much the whole of the fossil record all around the world today. Now, that's a radically different interpretation of exactly the same piece of evidence. So we don't argue about the evidence per se, but we have radically different interpretations. And the interpretations are based upon what we already believe. So let's summarize that. Experimental science is about the present, about observable and repeatable experiments. Historical science is about the unobservable, unrepeatable past. And friends, it's only in this area of historical science that there is any conflict between science and the Bible. There's never a conflict in experimental science. And if you think about it, there's no wonder there's a conflict in historical science, because one belief starts with the assumption there's no God and attempts to explain the universe based on that assumption. The other begins with the assumption there is a God and seeks to understand the universe based on that assumption. No wonder they are in conflict. So friends, science studies repeatable things, but history studies unrepeatable things. So how do we discover the truth about our origin? We can't go back to our origins, can we, and observe them. They're a one-off event that happened in the past. What we need, though, it's a bit like a crime scene. You need an eyewitness, don't you, to really resolve any ambiguity about what happened, particularly if the eyewitness is a trustworthy witness. We need someone who was there, who knows everything, who loves us and who would not deceive us, and who has written down everything we need to know about our origins. And friends, we have exactly that in this book, the Bible. You see, the Bible is God's eyewitness account of what he did right at the beginning, those opening chapters of Genesis. The Holy Spirit inspired the human authors to write in accordance with God's purposes and without error. So we can have confidence that what he has told us there is indeed the truth. But let me ask you this evening a question. Is your faith supported by evidence? Do you have blind faith? Are you just hanging on there, hoping this is true? You know, God in his grace has provided an abundance of supporting evidence. It takes such little faith to be a Christian. I want to use two images tonight. This first one is a tiny step of faith. This little girl is just putting her foot in the water there. You know, she can see that she's not going to plunge into some great abyss. But nonetheless, it still takes a little bit of faith to take that step. But the evidence supports her belief that she'll be okay. And what about this young fella? We just hope that he's checked, that there are no rocks underneath, that the water's deep enough. I want to use that to symbolise a leap of faith, believing something in spite of the evidence or even contrary to the evidence. Now, this history book of the Bible has some fascinating passages in it. Sometimes you see all these lists of names and ages and all this stuff, and you wonder, you know, why were they all put there? But I think God included those lists for very good reason, because it provides a timeline for us right from the very beginning. So at the top left-hand corner, we have Adam. Right across the top of the right-hand side is Abraham. There's about 2,000 years of elapsed time. And then from Abraham through to King David, and then via the line of Mary and the line of Joseph all the way to Jesus, is about another 2,000 years. And of course, from the time of Jesus to the present day is about 2,000 years. So according to the Bible, God's word, here we stand today about 6,000 years after the creation. Wow, 6,000 years. I mean, how can anyone seriously believe that in this day and age? You know, scientists cannot measure age. We hear such confident pronouncements that the age of this rock is so many millions of years, and the age of this fossil is so many millions or hundreds of thousands or something, and that the universe is 13.8 billion years old. But you see, age cannot be measured. Now, let me give you a little bit of an illustration. Come with me on a thought experiment. Let's say that you've just come around the corner of your house into the backyard, and there under a dripping tap is a bucket partly filled with water. Now, because you're scientifically inclined, you can't help yourself. You make some measurements, as you do, and you discover that the bucket has got 6 litres of water in it and the tap is dripping at half a litre every hour. So you ask yourself this all-important question: how long has the bucket been under the tap? Okay, 6 litres of water, half a litre per hour. Anyone want to tell me? How long has that bucket been under the tap? Any takers? 12 hours, I hear, 12 hours. Who thinks 12 hours? Yep. You could be right. But let's think about this. You have just chanced upon the scene. You did not see the bucket put under the tap. So to get 12 hours, we've had to make a number of assumptions. Who can tell me? What did we assume to get 12 hours? The bucket was empty when it went under the tap, but we don't know that. It might have been partly filled, mightn't it? What else did we assume? It's been dripping at the same rate. We don't know that either. You see, somebody could have turned the tap on hard, partly filled the bucket, turned the tap off carelessly, left it dripping just seconds before you came around the corner. You see, you cannot determine how long that bucket has been under the tap by observing the present rates at which things are happening. But let's imagine that your backyard is a very important backyard and you have a resident historian. Now, this historian faithfully records all the things that happen in your backyard, and they give you a document that tells you that at 1:05 p.m. this afternoon the bucket was placed under the tap, and at 1:50 p.m. you arrived on the scene. So now you ask the question, how long has the bucket been under the tap? Who wants to have a go at that one? Anyone? 45 minutes. Sounds pretty reasonable, doesn't it? Yeah, but hang on a minute. You're just a historian, right? I'm a scientist. And we have amazing technology today that can measure the volume of water in buckets by counting the very molecules. And I can measure the drip rate of taps to the nearest, I don't know, milliliter per century or some amazing precision. And you know what? When you apply all that amazing science, you're right, it's not really 12 hours. It was actually 11.973621. But with all my clever science and technology, am I any closer to the true answer? Who thinks I am? Who thinks I'm not? Well, you're right. Because the historian, the eyewitness, wins every time. Even with all the fancy technology, you still have to make a whole bunch of assumptions, don't you? You still don't know if the bucket was partly filled when it went under the tap, etc., etc. You see, we can reach a few key conclusions about determining the age of things. Firstly, ages cannot be measured. Scientists measure the physical and chemical properties of their sample, but you cannot measure age. Ages are only ever calculated. And the age you get depends upon the assumptions that you make. But worse than that, you can't test your assumptions because you can't go back into the past to see what was actually happening. You know, the only way that you can determine age accurately is with a reliable historical record. So where do you get the historical record of the universe from? God's word. That's the eyewitness account of what he actually did. And he's laid out for us a timeline within that book. Now, you'll read a lot about radiometric dating and the ages of rocks that have been dated using various dating methods. They're all very technical and complicated, but fundamentally they all work like this. You have a radioactively unstable element called the parent element that decays at a certain rate and produces what is called the daughter element. So if you want to measure the age of something, or calculate the age rather, you measure the ratio of the parent element to the daughter element and you can calculate the age, right? But you see, the same as the bucket of water, you've got all the same sets of assumptions you have to make. You don't know how much parent element or daughter element was there in the first place. You don't know if some's been added or subtracted. You actually don't know that the decay rate has been a constant. It turns out that there are 7 independent categories of assumptions which have to be made before an age can be determined. But all is not lost, because we can take some rocks of known age and use them to check out our dating methods. So how do you get a rock of known age? Well, a really good way is to take the rock from a lava dome, from an eruption which occurred on a known date. And there's a clock called the potassium argon clock. And this clock starts ticking when the lava solidifies. Argon is an inert gas. It'll bubble out of molten lava, but it gets trapped in the solidified basalt rock. So here are some examples. Mount St. Helens erupted in 1980. Rock taken from the lava dome was sampled and measured, and the results came back anywhere from 350,000 to 2.8 million years old. But at the time, the rocks were only about 10 years old. Here's another one. Kilauea in Hawaii, which every now and again bursts onto the headlines because it keeps erupting. But back about 200 years ago, there was an eruption, and from that lava, a rock has been dated anywhere from 0 to 22 million years old. And another one from Hawaii, Hualalai, similarly about 200 years old. And ages ranging from 160 million to 3.3 billion years old. All of them are wrong because observation tells us how old the rocks actually are. So if you get the wrong answer for rocks of known age, how can we have confidence in the results we get for rocks of unknown age? And not only that, different dating methods should give about the same results for things which must be about the same age. Here in Queensland, there's a place called Crinum, and there's a mine. They drilled down some 21 metres and discovered a layer of basalt lava which had flowed through a forest. There was still wood in the forest from the trees. It was still charred. The wood was carbon dated between 44 and 45,000 years old, but the basalt, using the potassium argon method, was dated at 45 million years old, a factor of 1,000 different for things which must be about the same age. Now, ladies, some of you here tonight will be wearing a diamond on your finger. Diamonds are called a girl's best friend, aren't they? Diamonds are the hardest naturally occurring form of carbon. So you can't get impurities into or out of diamonds in natural processes. They're believed to be between 1 and 3 billion years old. Now, there's a radioactively unstable form of carbon called carbon-14. You've probably heard about it. Carbon-14 decays quite rapidly. So rapidly, in fact, that after about 60 to 80,000 years, you'd be hard-pressed to even detect any. So if the diamonds are that old, there clearly could not possibly be any carbon-14 inside a diamond. Consequently, no one had ever bothered to look until a set of samples were sent to a dating laboratory and carbon-14 was found in each and every one. Significant quantities, not just background levels, indicating that the diamonds were only thousands of years old, not billions. We had an article in our Creation magazine, we called it Diamonds, a Creationist's Best Friend. Carbon-14 turns up routinely in coal, supposedly tens to hundreds of millions of years old. Can't possibly be carbon-14 in coal. Every single sample, once again, indicating ages of only thousands of years. But friends, thousands of years are consistent with the Bible's timescale, but hopelessly inconsistent with the evolutionary story. By the way, coal needs only weeks, not millions of years to form. What you need are the right ingredients and just modest temperature and pressure. It can be made in laboratories in quite short times. The air that we breathe consists of a number of different gases. One of them is helium. And helium is added into the atmosphere through radioactive decay processes in the Earth's crust. So there's a constant accumulation. Now, some of it manages to escape, but there's a net rate at which helium is building up in our atmosphere. So we can measure how much is there. We can measure the rate at which it's increasing. We can place an upper limit on the age of the atmosphere. And you know, all that helium would have got there in less than 2 million years. Well, hang on. That's a disaster for the evolutionary story, isn't it? Because it says the atmosphere can't be older than 2 million years. Life is supposed to have appeared on this earth billions of years ago, not just 2 million. We look around us in this world of ours, we find there are about 8 billion people on the planet. Do you know if you start with six people, Shem, Ham and Japheth, they're Noah's three sons and their wives, and let that population grow at the rate of just under 0.5% per annum, you know what you get? Over 4,500 years? About 8 billion. You see, the population of the world today is consistent with the Bible's record of history, but hopelessly inconsistent with the evolutionary story. Some people think that humans have been around for 100,000 years or even a million. If that were true, where are all the people? You see, we should be shoulder to shoulder on every square metre of the Earth's surface, including the ocean basins, and then some. But it's not like that, is it? Friends, there are so many different illustrations I could use. But I do commend this article to you on our website. It's on the age of the earth, and it lists 101 evidences for a young age of the earth and the universe. And you can find it there at creation.com/age. Now, it doesn't mean that there are only 101 evidences. There are many, many more than that. It's just that 101 has a nice ring to it. So we've got 101 of them in the article, and we occasionally cycle new ones through. So friends, it's actually a leap of faith to believe that the earth is billions of years old, because the evidence does not support that view. But what a tiny little step of faith to believe that the earth is just thousands of years old. The idea of the vast antiquity of the earth first came in the discipline of geology, and it came about because scientists interpreted the evidence in a certain way. You look at structures like Grand Canyon with all those layers and layers of rock, and the story goes like this. A flood or some disaster occurs and it lays down a layer of rock, and then some years later there's another one, then another one, and another one, and slowly we build up all those layers. It must have taken millions and millions of years. And in the case of the Grand Canyon, along comes the Colorado River and it carves out this massive canyon. Must have taken a phenomenal amount of time. So it's obvious, isn't it? Years, millions of years. But is it? Let's take a close look. Here are two layers, the Coconino sandstone on the top and the Hermit Formation underneath. The contact between those two, as you can see, is sharply defined and it's dead flat. And it extends for hundreds of kilometres in Grand Canyon. And layer after layer after layer after layer is the same. Now, the story goes that there's a 10 million year gap between the Hermit Formation and the Coconino sandstone on top. So that means the Hermit Formation was there, flat, for 10 million years. But wouldn't you expect to find some evidence of elapsed time? Like, there'd be signs of vegetation, tree roots, animal burrows, and the next time it rained, surely there'd be signs of erosion, creeks, rivers, valleys, and so on. Friends, there is no evidence of erosion anywhere on those boundaries. They're called flat gaps, and they are a great mystery. In fact, when we examine them, it suggests that they were laid down one after the other very rapidly with very little, if any, elapsed time between them. So have we ever observed a process that leaves behind that kind of signature? Well, we have. In 1980, Mount St. Helens in Washington State in the US erupted, caused significant geological change around the mountain, including the formation of this structure called Little Grand Canyon. It's called that because it's about 40 metres deep. It's about 1/40th the size of the real Grand Canyon. But can you see in the walls of the canyon all these layers and layers of rock? And there's a small river there flowing down in the bottom of the canyon. So if you apply the traditional interpretation, layer after layer must have taken many, many years for all that to be deposited, then that little river slowly carves out this big canyon, 1/40th the size of Grand Canyon. Friends, none of that material was even there before 1980. How do we know? We observed it to happen. Remember what science was about? It's about observation. Now, about 2 years after the initial eruption at Mount St. Helens, there was a massive mud flow through that area that carved out Little Grand Canyon. So how long do you think it would take to carve out a canyon 1/40th the size of the Grand Canyon? Who thinks it would take at least 6 months to do something like that? Anyone? No? Everybody thinks it's less. Oh, okay. You just all think I'm trying to trick you, don't you? You're probably right. So who thinks it would be between 1 and 6 months? Anyone? Yeah, got one hand. Who never puts their hand up if asked a question in church? Friends, it actually took 1 day. 1 day. A structure 1/40th the size of the Grand Canyon. And it's got all the signatures which are usually interpreted as meaning millions and millions of years. So, in the history book of the Bible, is there some event on a global scale a watery disaster described? You bet there is. Three whole chapters, Genesis 6, 7 and 8, describe the flood of Noah. And it says all the springs of the great deep burst forth, the floodgates of the heavens were opened. And the Bible goes on and says the waters rose and increased greatly on the earth. All the high mountains under the entire heavens were covered. Friends, this was a global watery disaster, the like of which this planet has never seen before or since. Some people think, well, maybe the flood was a local flood. You know, those old Jewish herdsmen sitting around campfires writing Genesis. They saw a flood in the Mesopotamian River Valley, and so they wrote about it. But look at the words. All, it says, the high mountains under the entire heavens were covered. So if you cover all the high mountains under the entire heavens, it has to be a global flood, doesn't it? How could it be a local flood? Unless, of course, it was something like this, which I guess is a bit bizarre, right? Clearly, that's not the case. And then people say, ah, but where did all the water go? It's one of those gotcha questions. People often come up with these. They think, ah, yeah, there's no answer to this one. Well, you know, with the courtesy of Google Earth, you can zoom back from over the Pacific Ocean. And there you can see the east coast of Australia in the lower left and the west coast of the US in the top right. There's a lot of water out there. Do you know, if you were to raise the ocean basins and lower the continents so that the Earth was a perfect sphere like a billiard ball, the water of the oceans would cover the surface of the Earth to a depth of nearly 3,000 metres. That is a lot of water. The evidence for the flood is everywhere. Just south of where Jenny and I live in Sydney is a beach, and on the end of that beach is a cliff face. And you can see there at the bottom there's a layer of mudstone, sedimentary rock. There's a coal-bearing deposit. Then that light-coloured layer is volcanic ash. And then another coal-bearing layer, then more volcanic ash, more coal, and a sedimentary layer on top of that. It speaks of a cataclysmic, watery, disastrous event punctuated by volcanic eruptions. This was no peaceful, calm thing. It was a tumultuous cataclysm. We also find evidence of fossilized tree trunks that run through multiple layers called polystrate fossils. We find them all over the world, in fact. Now, if the tree trunk sat there while the layers were formed slowly over thousands of years, I mean, the tree would rot away long since, wouldn't it? And so many of these are found without roots. So it appears that the tree has been ripped out of where it originally grew and then implanted down into freshly laid, moist, sedimentary layers. And then the layers we often find are incredibly folded and buckled. Now, I don't know about you, but has anyone here tried to bend a rock? What happens? Just shatters, doesn't it? But look at the bends in these rocks. All of those layers are beautifully preserved, tightly bent, no shattering on the corners. You see, while these layers were freshly laid, full of water, sodden, plastic, the Bible says the mountains rose up at the subsidence of the flood, the valleys sank down, the earth's crust would have been buckled and tortured, and folding of these freshly laid sedimentary rocks. And that is what we see. You know, the evidence in geology for the truth of the flood of Noah is absolutely everywhere. I want to play a short video clip for you from our DVD called Evolution's Achilles Heels. I think we've probably got some over there on the table, but you can get a hold of it through our website. And this shows some amazing images of water-formed mountains.
There are some things about modern mountain belts that we see that don't seem to fit with this conventional view. Rock is brittle. It doesn't bend very easily. If you try and bend it, it breaks. Now, granted, on a big scale, you might be able to get some pretty big bends out of a large rock. But these bends are tight and close, and you can walk from one end of them to the other. This type of bend and folding without breaking the brittle rock means that maybe it wasn't brittle rock at the time of its formation. These might have been much softer materials. After all, they were laid down during Noah's flood. They've been compacted down, started off horizontal, but then as the tectonic movements occurred, they shifted and folded them while they were probably still soft. So when we look at it this way, what we realize is that the really tall mountain chains, the Alps, the Rockies, the Himalayas, they didn't exist before the flood. The whole reason that they exist is because of the flood.
So basically, when we look at the geology of the Earth, we find that present processes do not explain what we see. Rather, what we see points to catastrophic processes in the past, and when we think about what those could be, it fits exactly with the account in Genesis of Noah's flood, which destroyed the whole earth.
What a magnificent photography. You see, those mountain ranges are there because of the flood. They were not there before the flood. So, you know, it's a huge leap of faith to believe that gradual processes shaped the major geological features on our planet. But what a tiny little step of faith to believe that a global flood best describes the major geological features. Now, you'll all be familiar with this picture of the fossil record. And down the left-hand side, there's usually the time scales with the usual millions and millions of years. And then a neatly ordered arrangement of fossils, starting from so-called simple organisms at the bottom all the way up to more complex organisms, vertebrates at the top, including mankind. And it's quite an iconic picture, but is it really like this? So I want to talk a little bit about the fossil record. You know, when scientists discover fossils, they don't have little tags on them saying how old they are, right? Now, I know that of course they don't, but the confidence with which the ages are stated would make you think that that's what it was like. So the scientists can study the physical and chemical properties of the samples that they have, and that is operational science, that's repeatable. But when they make pronouncements about the age, that's an interpretation, remember, which is based on what they already believe. That is historical science. So the fossils we find, interestingly, buried in sedimentary rocks. Now, sedimentary rocks are rocks that are laid down by water. And we see things like this as beautifully preserved fossil fish. Now, the story we get in our science textbooks and the like about how fish fossils form, and sometimes you'll see this on interpretive signs, goes something like this. And here's one such sign. The little fish is swimming happily along in a river or lake. It dies, sinks to the bottom, some sediment gets swept in, slowly covers over the body, whereupon, in due course, it becomes a fossil. Now, this story here is just that. It's a story about the unobserved past. It's historical science. But let's do some observable science. Does anybody here keep fish, or have you ever kept fish? Anyone? Yeah? Yep. If the fish died, did they sink to the bottom of the tank or did they float to the top? Almost always they will float to the top, won't they? And if that happens in nature, what happens then? Other fish will eat it, right? Birds will pick at it. Before long, there's just a few bony remains. They will sink to the bottom and then the crustaceans will get rid of those. You can test this out with some observable science. Next time you go snorkeling or scuba diving, look down at the ocean floor. Will you see all those dead fish lying there waiting to become fossils? It's not like that, is it? You see, to form a fossil, we need special conditions. And one of those special conditions is that we need to bury it rapidly so that predators can't get to the body. So here's an interesting example. This is a marine creature called an ichthyosaur. Happens to be a female ichthyosaur. I wonder how you can you see how I know that it is a female? As I point out often, it's got cute little eyelashes and nice flippers. It's in the act of giving birth. Can you see the baby ichthyosaur there emerging from the mother's birth canal? Now, ladies, I've heard of long labours, but not thousands of years, right? This creature, in the act of giving birth, was dumped on by tons of mud and sediment and trapped in the rocks. What about this guy? He didn't even get time to finish eating his lunch. And here we have a conga line of trilobites, all preserved in order. Now, if that was how could that have been a slow process? It must have happened almost instantaneously. In fact, in their report, the scientists said, whatever the reason for these fossilised trilobite lineups, one thing is clear, they must have formed rapidly. But rapid burial is consistent with the effects of Noah's flood, because it was a catastrophic event, not a slow, gradual, gentle rising of the waters, nothing like that at all. So to form a fossil, we need several conditions. We need rapid burial, we need a lack of predation, we need oxygen deprivation so the body can't rot away, and we need continued sediment accumulation so that the predators can't dig it up. And you know, all of those conditions are consistent with a global flood just like that described in Genesis. So I think fish fossils form something like this. The little fish is swimming happily along, gets dumped on by tons of mud and sediment, ends up trapped in the layers of rock, whereupon it dutifully becomes a fossil. The fossil record is a mute testimony to the truth and the accuracy of the historical record in Genesis. It's exactly what you would expect to find if the Genesis account was true. Now, we're told that the fossil record shows this gradation over time as things change from simple to more complex things. But there's a mystery in the fossil record called living fossils. And these are fossils that we find in the fossil record, but we find their living counterparts alive and well today. Here are some examples. The sea urchin, believed to be from the Cretaceous periods, 140 to 65 million years ago, but exactly the same. Liquid amber leaves, supposedly 20 million years old, but exactly the same as today's liquid amber leaves. The ginkgo tree, the fossil and the modern, no change. Supposed to be a lineage of almost 300 million years, no change. And the coelacanth, an amazing fish that was once thought to be a transition between fish and land-walking animals. And it was believed to have gone extinct 300 million years ago until someone caught one in the Indian Ocean back in 1938. Since then, many have been found and caught. No change. A dragonfly. Look at this fossilised dragonfly wing. 200 million years old, apparently. But here's the living dragonfly. And let me just remove the rock. Look at that. No change. 200 million years. So evolution's supposed to produce change, except when it doesn't. You see, the evolutionary story can be adjusted to suit any purpose. So where are all the intermediate fossils? Charles Darwin recognised that the fossil record did not support his theory. And he very wisely said this, why then is not every geological formation and every stratum full of such intermediate links? Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain. And this, perhaps, is the most obvious and serious objection that can be urged against the theory. But Darwin believed that as more and more fossil evidence was found, it would fit his theory. So, 150-something years later, this gentleman, Dr. Colin Patterson, a paleontologist, wrote a book about fossils. Someone wrote to him about the book and he wrote back and said this, "I fully agree with your comments on the lack of direct illustration of evolutionary transitions in my book. If I knew of any fossil or living, I would certainly have included them. I will lay it on the line. There is not one such fossil for which one could make a watertight argument." Isn't that amazing? I love the admissions, the unguarded moments when the scientists admit, well, actually, there isn't any evidence for what we believe. So who's taking the leap of faith here? Is it the Christian or is it the secularist? What about the dinosaur family tree? Here we are in the Chicago Field Museum of Natural History. It shows the tree of all these dinosaurs and their intermediate forms and all the way back to a common ancestor. So here are the number of fossil samples that have been found of each of those types. Hope you can see the numbers there. Some of them are quite large, 200,000 plus there. Some are relatively small, just a couple hundred or 46, or six in the case of the one at the top. But how many fossil examples do we have of the intermediate links? Turns out, not one. There is no evidence at all in the fossil record of a common ancestor. Science Journal published this dinosaur evolutionary tree. And they had a number of bridging lines. Now, just to make them a bit clearer, we've coloured in the bridges that have been assumed in this dinosaur family tree picture. But when you take them away, what are you left with? There's no tree at all. Just fossil records of different kinds of dinosaurs. And of course, we're probably all very familiar with this classic icon of evolution. The ape to man transition. It appears everywhere, doesn't it? A colleague of mine, Scott Devlin, recorded this next little video clip, and I think he sums up the evidence extremely well. Let's listen to Scott.
You may recognize this image from school textbooks, t-shirts, soda adverts, and everything in between. But what if I were to tell you that if we're to be honest with the evidence that we have, this picture should look more like this. Let me explain. On the left is what is believed to be the first ape, known as Proconsul, and on the right is a human called Homo sapiens. But what scientific evidence is there for everything else in this image? The transitional species. Let's find out. We'll start with Homo neanderthalensis. You might know him as Neanderthal man. Recent discoveries have shown that Neanderthal man made and wore jewelry, played instruments, used tools, and wore makeup. We've even found that his brain was the same or slightly larger than the average human living today. In other words, Neanderthal man was actually just a man. What about Homo erectus? Recent discoveries have shown that Homo erectus made tools, engaged in artwork, spoke intelligent language, and made and sailed boats. In other words, Homo erectus was also just a man. Now we'll come back to Homo habilis in a moment, but first, let me show you something. Have you ever heard of Lucy, the most famous so-called ape man, paraded in our museums, one of the very first Australopithecus afarensis species ever to be found? But what does the evidence reveal? She had a skull that was sloped and ape-like, nothing like human skulls. Fingers that were curved, not at all like human fingers. Toes that were curved, not at all like human toes. Wrists that had the ability to lock for knuckle walking, and a knee structure that was compatible with life in trees. So Lucy and her kind swung from trees and looked like today's apes. Lucy is an extinct type of ape. As we've just seen, Homo sapiens, Neanderthal man, and Homo erectus were all men. Australopithecus afarensis and Proconsul were both apes. Considering the ubiquity of the evolutionary icon, we'd really want to see some strong evidence for Homo habilis, the pivotal point of transition between stoop ape and upright man, between basic instinct and intelligent thought, between animal noise and intelligent speech. The only problem is, in the words of Ian Tattersall, Homo habilis is a wastebasket taxon, little more than a convenient recipient for a motley assortment of hominin fossils. Other scientists referred to him as a garbage bag because the bones we have for him are a mixture of human and ape bones. In other words, Homo habilis never existed. I think evolutionary professor Bernard Wood sums this up well. Our progress from ape to human looks so smooth, so tidy, it's such a beguiling image that even the experts are loath to let it go. But it is an illusion. With the lack of evidence and agreement on the ape-human transition forms, why is this not happening? Or this? And is a better explanation that man and apes have always coexisted and reproduced according to their own kind, as stated in Genesis 1.
I think he sums that up very well, doesn't he? God created all the kinds to reproduce after their own kind. And that's exactly what we see happening today. I like this quote. Now, evolution is the substance of fossils hoped for, the evidence of links not seen. My apologies to the author of Hebrews 11:1. But you know, we're often told that we're genetically similar to the chimpanzees, right? There's hardly any difference. Only 2%, we're told, but you know, even if that was true, which it's not, that's still 60 million base pairs or letters of information different. But this similarity is actually grossly overstated. I want to share a very short clip with you that comes from a secular website. This is not one of ours. This is the secularists admitting to how these numbers came about. Quite revealing.
When researchers sat down to compare the chimp and human genomes, those single letter differences were easy to tally, but the big mismatch sections weren't. For example, if a genetic paragraph, thousands of letters long, appears twice in a human scroll, but only once in its chimp counterpart, should that second human copy count as thousands of changes or just one? And what about identical paragraphs that appear in both genomes, but in different places or in reverse order, or broken up into pieces? Rather than monkey around with these difficult questions, the researchers simply excluded all the large mismatch sections, a whopping 1.3 billion letters in all, and performed a letter-by-letter comparison on the remaining 2.4 billion, which turned out to be 98.77% identical. So, yes, we share 99% of our DNA with chimps if we ignore 18% of their genome and 25% of ours.
Ever so slightly misleading, isn't it? We have to ignore 25% of the chimp genome, 18% of ours. Oh yes, and then you get a high correlation. But you know, it's no wonder. The genome describes, among other things, the structure of the organism. And guess what? We and chimps have two arms, two legs, two eyes, two ears, a nose, a mouth. We have a rib cage, a spine. There is a lot of structural similarity. No wonder there is such strong similarity. But it's nowhere near what we are told. So when we look at the geological timescale and the fossil record, a much, much better and more realistic interpretation is that the fossil record represents the order in which things were buried during the flood. So it's a massive leap of faith to believe that the fossil record shows evolution over eons of time. But what a tiny little step of faith to believe that the fossil record shows the order of burial by the flood. Friends, I used this scripture at the beginning. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have, but to do it with gentleness and respect. So how do you get to be prepared? Well, that's what our ministry is aimed at doing. And we've given you a whole bunch of information here tonight, a lot of which you'll forget, but if you get onto the website, that will help you. And remember that amazing web address, dead easy, isn't it? You can also get a free email newsletter service. We send one out approximately one or two weekly, and it gives you a good summary of some of the key articles that were on the website. If there's something happening in your local area, we can let you know about it. The very first email you get will give you access to a free video download and excellent talk. Now, you're probably thinking, oh, not another email, and I know what that's like. But friends, we don't sell your email address to anybody else, and of course you can always unsubscribe if you wish. But let me assure you, if you get the InfoBytes emails, it's a wonderful way of staying up to date. Over on the counter over there, you'll find a form that looks like this. We just need your name, your email address, and your postcode. And if you sign up tonight for InfoBytes, we'll give you a free booklet, Stones and Bones, which looks at the evidence in geology and paleontology. Of course, you can stay plugged into our ministry via the usual social media channels, and as I mentioned earlier, the Creation magazine. And this is a marvellous resource aimed at lay people. You don't have to be a scientist to understand it. And we get so many encouraging testimonies from people whose lives have been impacted by Creation magazine. Jenny and I had four children, as I shared this morning. We sadly lost our eldest. But all of our kids were raised on a solid diet of Creation magazine. All of them went on to be with the Lord and to walk with the Lord. And that's, I know, due to many other factors, not the least of which is just the grace of God. But Creation magazine gave them a firm grounding. You can get four issues a year, and you can subscribe for 1 or 3 years. And with every subscription tonight, you'll get a free back issue. So you've got something to take away with you, to read, and then hopefully to give away. With the print issue comes also a digital subscription if you give us an email address. And that's a wonderful way in which you can share this resource with other people. I love this testimony we received. This guy said, "I was converted when someone gave me a Creation magazine." Isn't that amazing? Someone just gave him one and now he's in the kingdom. But I love what he did next. "Then I subscribed for 5 of my relatives. 4 of them have now come to the Lord." So over on our resource tables there, you'll find a form, looks like this, and fill that out with the necessary details. Now, if you take out a 3-year subscription tonight, you'll get a $15 voucher, which you can use on any of the materials over there on the tables. A great way to spend your $15 is to purchase a Creation Answers book. It consists of 20 short chapters that address the most asked questions that Christians and non-Christians alike have. Things like, for instance, how do I know there's a God? Where did all the water go after the flood? Well, we talked about that, didn't we? And a classic question that comes time and again, where did Cain get his wife? All there in the Answers book. We've packaged that up with a DVD on why this issue is important and a little blue booklet there, Refuting Evolution, which has sold over 500,000 copies. And that intro pack is discounted, so it's like buying 2 of those things and getting the 3rd one for free. If you want to dig deep, I'd recommend this one, The Genesis Account. It's a theological, historical, and scientific commentary on the first 11 chapters. This one is an excellent look at the deep time deception by Michael Ord, and it's mostly oriented around geology. If you know young people who are in late high school or perhaps going into university, this is a great little booklet, The Creation Survival Guide, How to Graduate with Your Faith Intact. And we have a great array of videos which you can get from the website, and you can stream them or purchase them for your own use. Now, this morning I shared a summary, and I want to repeat it because I think it's very helpful to see. This is the big picture, according to the Bible, of all history. And it begins with the creation of an original perfect world in which there was no sin, no suffering, no pain, no death. But Adam's rebellion brought the intrusion of those bad things. And that is the world, friends, that we live in today. It's a broken world. It's not the same as the original creation. The Bible also tells us that there will come a new heaven and a new earth. And it will be a restoration of the original creation. In fact, it'll be better than that because there'll be no prospect ever of sin and death entering the new earth. Now, if you're like me, when I was growing up, I tried to mix the millions of years into my Christian understanding. And if you do that, it takes that top left-hand corner out of the picture. But can you see what's happened now? That means that God must have created the world full of suffering and death. So what does that say about the goodness of our God? How can he be good if he does that? And it's even worse than that, because is the new earth a restoration to more suffering and death? You see, friends, if the millions of years are true, there's no hope for the future either. That's why it is so important that we place that top left-hand corner back into our understanding. And that is what we find in those opening chapters of the book of Genesis. So friends, when we share Jesus with this lost and dying world, we need to remember, number one, he's the creator of the universe. He's the perfect, sinless sacrifice who gave his life for us so that we could go free. The Bible says that he's seated at the right hand of God the Father, interceding for each and every one of us. He's the soon coming king. He's the bridegroom seated at that wedding feast to which we have all been invited. So friends, if you're a believer here tonight and you've not known what to do about this whole issue of origins, let me encourage you, get equipped, get onto the website, get hold of the magazine, get hold of materials and build yourself up in the faith. If you've never taken that step of faith before, I would encourage you to do so. It's the best decision that you will ever make. Friends, I really appreciate your attention here tonight. It's been such a privilege to share with you, but I hope you understand the importance and the gravity of this issue. Make sure you know that you stand on the truth of the Word of God and be confident when you proclaim it to those around you. God bless. Thank you.